Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. Gurov in Manhattan by Ehud Havazaleh. On a January day, a little before 9 in the morning, this was the situation. Sokolov, 52, lecturer in Russian literature at Lehman College in the Bronx, 2 years post-transplant for leukemia, stood on Riverside Drive looking north to Canada, while Lermontov, his suffering aged wolfhound, tried with trembling extensions to relieve himself looking south towards New Orleans. The day was cold, scrubbed clear, one of the January days in New York that slice through you and deride your hopes that winter will ever open its fist. The vet, a young woman with auburn hair, braided, and an athlete's bony litheness, the kind who caught Sokolov's eye, the kind whose eye he used to catch, alas, no longer, told him dogs Lermontov's size were lucky to reach 10, 11. If, as Sokolov said, he was 13, it was a miracle, and she smiled at the dog tenderly, while Sokolov, she didn't know him, thought sourly that only the carelessly youthful and naive and healthy could have the gall to think surviving is blessing enough. It had not snowed in a week, and the last storm's remnants were pocked glacial outcroppings crusted with soot and cigarette ends and animal droppings. Alas, again, none Lermontov's. In the trees along the drive, half a dozen crows perched without a sound. Sokolov chanced a quick peek. The dog had an intestinal blockage, perhaps a tumor, and on top of the diabetes was too old for surgery. 13, Sokolov had said. Could be 35 for all he knew. He was Kelly's dog, and Kelly wasn't there to ask, was she? If he didn't somehow, more miracles, come through in the next few days, it wasn't fair to let him suffer. Again, Sokolov stared broadly at the pretty young face that hadn't more than glanced at his in passing since he hauled the reluctant dog through the office door. Let him suffer, as if she knew, as if anybody knew the tipping point between life's durance and life's ending. 10 years ago, this might have been his opening, the moment he'd inject a wry observation, oblique, evocative, European. This morning he'd simply said, "How many?" Still looking at the dog, maybe if he set himself on fire, she'd said, "How many what? Days." Then she did look, as if that fact, the number, and Sokolov's bringing it up was tactless indeed, and made her unwillingly see him, gruff, bothered, indifferent, balding, gaunt, nearing toothlessness. He was past caring what she thought. He'd been given numbers once, a lot of them, none good. He'd wanted to know, and now he assumed Lermontov wanted it also. "I don't know exactly," the doctor said. "Let's say 2. 2, Sokolov answered, barely noticing she ignored the witticism. He paid at the desk, stopped by the door to give the dog a couple of good whomping pats to the side, the way he liked it, then made the 10-block walk to their corner, where they, Sokolov looking one direction, the dog another, waited for what was next. Time was, Sokolov wanted everything. Now he wanted less. Or more precisely, this is what Sokolov wanted, to want less. Coming to this country with dreams not all that different from or more realistic than the conquistador's visions of El Dorado, he'd thought that the combination of his past, Leningrad, gray, his education, doctoral thesis, response to the pastoral in Theodore Dreiser, laughingly, wrong-headed, unpublished, his genealogy, rabbis, radicals, a thunderous drunk or two, and his, by general report, Slavic handsomeness and insouciant old-world charm ensured he would be welcomed, transformed from the young man with an old man's maladies, melancholy, dyspepsia, free to wander in this big fat orchard America and pluck its ripest fruit. 2 unfinished novels and an incinerated memoir later, a dozen odd ignored applications to schools out of the city, floored by the hoof of a Cossack horse kick by cancer, left alive but with tingling blue-edged fingers, toes, riotous bowels, hair not only grayed and thinning but matted like a horsehair blanket, he was an old man with an old man's maladies, and alone, Kelly, after 3 years, was gone, and Sokolov still couldn't believe how quickly, how briskly, how efficiently this woman he'd lived with had disappeared from his life, leaving only her declining dog as a remembrance. How long would Lermontov take? As pathetic as his silent clenching was, he'd dutifully stand there and try for an hour if Sokolov didn't, with a flick of the leash, release him. Were it warmer or Lermontov younger, maybe he'd leave them tied to the meter outside the coffee shop, continue his lacerating study of the waitress there, Amity. Chancing another bleak glance, he saw Lermontov motionless, maybe done, but then beginning again the stiffening, hopeless crouch, the shakes working from the legs up that indicated he was still, who could blame him, trying. How had they met? He, Kelly, the dog. It was, for once, something actually out of a book. Sokolov, on his mid-afternoon stroll, after what was probably a fruitless morning laboring over an essay, banging his head against the lunacy of American academic prose, thicket of colons, slashed made-up new words, snide elusive jargon of a boys' club, lunch a quick sandwich and black scalding coffee, he had come out to give his frustration some air. There on a bench, Kelly, reading a thick hardback, long-limbed in red pants, brown sweater, lissome even in silhouette, massed jet black hair untidily stirruped over a shoulder. Lermontov, younger then, regally bored, looking straight ahead as if nothing he'd seen warranted a turn of the eye, immediately gaining Sokolov's admiration. Bored as a dog, Sokolov figured. What else do I have going today? And after sitting on the bench's far edge, patting the dog once, twice, ventured, "You know there's a famous Russian story about two people meeting over a dog." Kelly took a moment, as if she needed first to finish a sentence in her book, then turned on Sokolov, two astonishing brown eyes. "Yes," Kelly said, "but the dog was white and small, and it didn't turn out too well for the lovers." He'd not used the term intentionally. "Didn't it?" Sokolov said, assuming his best devil-may-care roguish grin. And that was that. Kelly was finishing a doctoral course at the university, comp lit and women's studies. She was what Sokolov pretended to be, but disagreeably knew he really wasn't, anarchic and determined and free of constraint. When they made love, she entered into it with such vigorous abandon he wondered if she remembered he was there. The same night she'd cook an enormous lamb stew he could still summon the taste of. She had drunk at least as much of 3 bottles of wine as Sokolov, and by the time she perused his heaped bookshelves and piles of untidy notes with a scholar's proprietary eye, wearing just panties and one of his button-downs, then settling into the easy chair, Sokolov's favorite, with a new translation of Turgenev he'd been meaning to get to, Sokolov was, as they like to say here, head over heels. When he saw and commented on her studio apartment, shabby, unlit, it seemed only natural for her to pack up and move in with him. It was 2 months into their relationship. Kelly was already calling him Gurov. He superstitiously desisted from calling her Anna. Sokolov had found a true friend in Lermontov, another refugee cast below his station in life, also not a complainer. And they had lugged her boxes and plants and fancy Scandinavian mattress up in the cramped service elevator. Kelly bought new shower curtains and lined his dusty shelves with paper, a 3-foot ficus that immediately began the business of dying in the thin air shaft light, and they started. 3 years of life, desultory happiness, maybe, a restiveness almost welcome for the torrential manner in which Kelly would respond to it. Conferences, hers, San Francisco, Montreal, his, Camden, Baltimore, a wild trip through the Adirondacks, this was early, drinking chilled vodka from the bottle and listening to Shaliapin on Sokolov's old tapes, 8 days in Key West, unconvincingly joining the resident vacationers who gathered at the pier each night to pay homage to the sunset, drinking too much at Hemingway's bar, talking to everyone, this was later, but each other. Waking with pounding headaches and the brittle realization they were sullen, disconsolate, exhausted. So? Tolstoy had hated no one as much as his wife, and they stayed together. Chekhov, based on geographical evidence, enjoyed his actress wife more through the mail than in the house. Who in his right mind expected everything? Sokolov, apparently. Then the illness, life slamming its lid on him, and Kelly, who had perhaps considered many experiences would come to her at 28, but caring for a terrified middle-aged Russian who clung to her harder the more his terror rose, was certainly not one of them. Yes, Sokolov was no model patient. Yes, he tolerated the sunny prattle of the nurses with ill-concealed impatience. Yes, he raged. Yes, cursed and wept. Yes, when the drugs wrecked his stomach and the radiation stripped his mouth and tongue bare, he allowed himself great waves of pity and remorse. And yes, 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 he behaved nothing like what he would have written for himself, if he still wrote. Not the moody, doomed poetry of Pushkin, but the frantic, unmanned panic of the clerk in Gogol's story, which Sokolov had always dismissed as sentimental, a febrile hallucination until one day he found himself living it. Kelly had stayed. He would not forget. Stayed through the treatments and the endless doctor's visits, the biopsies and tests, the nights on morphine when Sokolov dreamed a landscape of tiny men burrowing with axes in his brain, the fevers and chills. When, had he the strength, he would have wished to die. Kelly had stayed. So then, when for the 4th 6-month interval his biopsies were clear, when she had asked every possible responsible question of the doctors and nurses and pharmacists and social workers, after an uncharacteristically quiet, relaxed Sokolov, idiot, had thought, dinner, she announced she had accepted a position at a women's college in Virginia and would be leaving. Now Sokolov was all right. All right. Floored, flummoxed. He had again drunk too much wine, and his ruined innards were letting him know what they thought about it. Sokolov searched for his old poise like a man fumbling through a closet in the dark. What of the Chekhov story? Didn't she remember? Gurov, Anna, the hard part? What if they had survived that, the hard part? What if now would be easy? But Kelly was a student of literature, a better one, Sokolov knew, than he, and she looked at him in pain and weary apology, but unshaken in the knowledge of what he knew as well. Chekhov hadn't written this story, and when he had returned from answering his intestines' calamitous summons, she had a suitcase out, and the ficus, grandson to the first, also deceased, was poking spindly branches at Sokolov from the trash bin where Kelly had tossed it. A shift in the breeze scooped even colder air from the river as a rich man in a camel-hair coat talked into a phone and followed two galumphing bassets across 108th. They paused by Lermontov, who, after a half-hearted sniff, ignored them, and the man, who kept telling somebody on the phone, "That's not what I said, I never said anything like that," was hauled on his leashes past Sokolov up the drive. The crows, now as if struggling to stay awake, flapped a wing or shifted position in the branches. Lermontov and his owner regarded each other a wordless moment. Then Sokolov, not bothering to examine his motives, turned himself and the dog toward Broadway and the odd pleasurable torment of contemplation and regret that awaited him daily at the coffee shop. Amity was her name. It would have to be. She'd been there 6 weeks, 4 since Kelly had traveled south. Mid-20s, briskly attractive, blonde, toned. She rode a bike to work, even in this weather. With lit blue eyes, it stopped Sokolov in his tracks every time. What would it be to have those eyes look at you? A forensic sociologist, self-appointed, Sokolov, failed writer, had made a study of the issue. What alchemical burst in the cortex, what detonation of the synapses, what pheromonal heaving in every nerve and muscle was set off by beauty, made the male animal tense with opportunity, recognition before awareness, led just by instinct's unwavering dowser. What symmetry of feature or cadence of glance and response, what shimmer of illuminata in a passing eye, would suddenly become Beatrice, Helen, your Tatiana or Anna or Dolores Hayes? What in your hollow, dried-up receding made you feel suddenly alive? A turning point in his reckonings had come when he first saw the girl. She was on break at the counter on the rotating stools, reading a paper. Sokolov was paying his bill. Coffee, soup, a hard roll, when he saw her and something wheeling in him froze. Amity, he'd learn her name the next day. The loose, disregarded hair, the perfect chin and shoulder, then the blue eyes suggesting behind them an empyrean spring eternity joy. He stood there like a gawker at a country fair, and she eventually looked up, took him in a second, and returned to page 6. Nothing had cut him so deeply in years. Sokolov, old world conqueror, who had held the gaze of every woman in his novels class, who had wooed dozens just by a line from Herzen or a pose struck thoughtfully looking out the window, who had slept with half the humanities faculty at Lehman, knew all at once age, irrelevance, invisibility, and standing there with a $5 bill in his hand for the first time since the terrifying clap of mortality when the doctor pronounced the diagnosis, felt the brush of the dark angel's wing on his neck. And since he had returned daily to verify the sensation, rage, and concede, and quietly wonder at the many ways we pass into insubstantiality, an old fool in love. Lermontov, who in his nimble youth would bound at traffic, particularly cabs, as if their presence in his street were outrageous, now stood on the west side of the avenue looking back uncertainly at Sokolov. "Just a quick cup of coffee," Sokolov assured him, "then for you a big bowl of soup." North on the avenue the light was dimmer, a gray haze suggesting more snow. Not quite dragging the dog, Sokolov made it across the street, bent to tie the aggrieved animal to the parking meter in front of Tom's, assured him with a pat and a word or two, turned to go inside. And there she was, Amity, talking with another waitress through the smeared half-steamed window at the counter, maybe 5 feet from where Sokolov and his dog stood watching. It was like watching a scene from a movie, Lupich, maybe. She was crying, or had been, and the other waitress, a broad-backed matron who must have been here when LaGuardia came looking for free pie, had her arm on Amity, gently rubbing the muscled back of her black leotard. And then it happened. Sokolov, who for weeks had been wanting nothing more than a look of interest, of open feeling, of vulnerability from this young woman, got it. Through the window she locked eyes with him, and the look she gave was such fresh, youthful misery that it was Sokolov, voyeur emeritus, who turned away. As the movie shifted scenes, his visions, one by one, drifted toward him and disappeared. Amity turning her head when he finally found the right thing to say, about to laugh. Amity on his couch, cradling a big glass of wine. Amity in his bed, flushed, exhausted, satisfied. Borodin on the stereo. Or, if she was another Kelly, Shostakovich. Amity, such an odd, enclosed, crystalline word. He knew nothing about her. It was much easier getting the dog back across Broadway. Maybe he had heard Sokolov's telepathic offer of soup. Maybe he just wanted to get out of the cold. Passing the bank and the falafel stand and the cut-rate sundries shop, Sokolov felt himself relent, slipped into quiet sadness of relief and withdrawal, of repudiation. He remembered the moment in the Chekhov where Gurov, having gotten what he wanted from Anna, pauses to eat a watermelon on the table. There followed at least half an hour of silence, the story read. Sokolov's teachers had seen this as further proof of Gurov's heartlessness. Done with his conquest, why not a fortifying snack? But this reading never sat quite right with Sokolov, who was sounder in his doubts than in his disorganized assertions regarding them. Was it possible Gurov, knowing only the buoyant pulse of seduction, had here first actually seen the woman whose life he was about to change? And his own, internally shifting from snatched temporary disposable affection to something else, deeper, permanent, at so much greater cost? This is what swept through Sokolov's head as he followed Lermontov, the old dog suddenly moving fast, nearly racing past the sleepy doorman and people rushing toward the subway. What had he to offer this girl, this stranger? He remembered no poetry. He could give her no advice about whoever had made her cry. At least it wasn't Sokolov. "Face it, old man," he told himself, reflecting on his once-ever-spry organ. Now a flabby, curled-up pasha who would, since the chemo, never again see reason to stir himself. When Sokolov closed his eyes at night, trilobites swam in the darkness before him. What had he to offer? Nothing. Let her live her life. And an image of Kelly, on a campus someplace warmer, carrying books from the library. Kelly, too. At their corner, Sokolov, ready for a nap, moved toward the stairs. But Lermontov pulled him back to the soiled bank of snow. Why not? Sokolov scanned the branches, but the crows that had seemed immovable earlier now were gone. East somewhere, over Garden City, Mineola, the sun, angled low, broke a moment through the clouds, and Sokolov saw his shadow and the crouching dog stretched westward in the street, then vanished when the sun again drew back. Lermontov, with what might be pride or relief or happy fatigue, stood before a small cluster of curled brown turds. Sokolov found the plastic bag in his pocket, cleaned up, gave the dog a solid pat, another, looked back at Broadway a moment, over at the river and New Jersey, then followed the straining dog up the broad cement stairs toward their apartment and the promised bowl of soup. And that story was Gurov in Manhattan by Ehud Hevezaleh from Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. The Vane Sisters by Vladimir Nabokov. I might never have heard of Cynthia's death had I not run that night into D, whom I had also lost track of for the last 4 years or so. And I might never have run into D had I not got involved in a series of trivial investigations. The day, a compunctious Sunday after a week of blizzards, had been part jewel, part mud. In the midst of my usual afternoon stroll through the small hilly town attached to the girls' college where I taught French literature, I had stopped to watch a family of brilliant icicles drip-dripping from the eaves of a frame house. So clear-cut were their pointed shadows on the white boards behind them that I was sure the shadows of the falling drops should be visible, too. But they were not. The roof jutted too far out, perhaps, or the angle of vision was faulty, or again I did not chance to be watching the right icicle when the right drop fell. There was a rhythm, an alternation in the dropping that I found as teasing as a coin trick. It led me to inspect the corners of several house blocks, and this brought me to Kelly Road, and right to the house where Dee used to live when he was an instructor there. And as I looked up at the eaves of the adjacent garage with its full display of transparent stalactites backed by their blue silhouettes, I was rewarded at last, upon choosing one, by the sight of what might be described as the dot of an exclamation mark, leaving its ordinary position to glide down very fast, a jot faster than the thaw drop it raced. This twin twinkle was delightful but not completely satisfying, or rather it only sharpened my appetite for other tidbits of light and shade, and I walked on in a state of raw awareness that seemed to transform the whole of my being into one big eyeball rolling in the world's socket. Through peacock lashes I saw the dazzling diamond reflection of the low sun on the round back of a parked automobile. To all kinds of things a vivid pictorial sense had been restored by the sponge of the thaw. Water in overlapping festoons flowed down one sloping street and turned gracefully into another. With ever so slight a note of meretricious appeal, narrow passages between buildings revealed treasures of brick and purple. I remarked for the first time the humble fluting, last echoes of grooves on the shafts of columns, ornamenting a garbage can, and I also saw the rippling upon its lid, circles diverging from a fantastically ancient center. Erect, dark-headed shapes of dead snow, left by the blades of a bulldozer last Friday, were lined up like rudimentary penguins along the curbs, above the brilliant vibration of live gutters. I walked up and I walked down, and I walked straight into a delicately dying sky, and finally the sequence of observed and observant things brought me, at my usual eating time, to a street so distant from my usual eating place that I decided to try a restaurant which stood on the fringe of the town. Night had fallen without sound or ceremony when I came out again. The lean ghost, the elongated umbra cast by a parking meter upon some damp snow, had a strange ruddy tinge. This I made out to be due to the tawny red light of the restaurant sign above the sidewalk, and it was then, as I sauntered there, wondering rather wearily if in the course of my return tramp I might be lucky enough to find the same in neon blue, it was then that a car crunched to a standstill near me, and Dee got out of it with an exclamation of feigned pleasure. He was passing on his way from Albany to Boston, through the town he had dwelt in before, and more than once in my life have I felt that stab of vicarious emotion followed by a rush of personal irritation against travelers who seem to feel nothing at all upon revisiting spots that ought to harass them at every step with wailing and writhing memories. He ushered me back into the bar that I had just left, and after the usual exchange of buoyant platitudes came the inevitable vacuum which he filled with the random words, "Say, I never thought there was anything wrong with Cynthia Vane's heart. My lawyer tells me she died last week." 2. He was still young, still brash, still shifty, still married to the gentle, exquisitely pretty woman who had never learned or suspected anything about his disastrous affair with Cynthia's hysterical young sister, who in her turn had known nothing of the interview I had had with Cynthia when she suddenly summoned me to Boston to make me swear I would talk to Dee and get him kicked out if he did not stop seeing Sybil at once, or did not divorce his wife, whom incidentally she visualized through the prism of Sybil's wild talk as a termagant and a fright. I had cornered him immediately. He had said there was nothing to worry about, had made up his mind anyway to give up his college job and move with his wife to Albany where he would work in his father's firm, and the whole matter, which had threatened to become one of those hopelessly entangled situations that drag on for years, with peripheral sets of well-meaning friends endlessly discussing it in universal secrecy, and even founding among themselves new intimacies upon its alien woes, came to an abrupt end. I remember sitting next day at my raised desk in the large classroom where a mid-year examination in French Lit was being held on the eve of Sybil's suicide. She came in on high heels with a suitcase, dumped it in a corner where several other bags were stacked, with a single shrug slipped her fur coat off her thin shoulders, folded it on her bag, and with two or three other girls stopped before my desk to ask when I would mail them their grades. It would take me a week, beginning from tomorrow, I said, to read the stuff. I also remember wondering whether Dee had already informed her of his decision, and I felt acutely unhappy about my dutiful little student as during 150 minutes my gaze kept reverting to her, so childishly slight and close-fitting gray, and kept observing that carefully waved dark hair, that small, small flowered hat with the little Highland veil as worn that season, and under it her small face broken into a cubist pattern by scars due to a skin disease, pathetically masked by a sun lamp tan that hardened her features, whose charm was further impaired by her having painted everything that could be painted, so that the pale gums of her teeth between cherry red chapped lips and the diluted blue ink of her eyes under darkened lids were the only visible openings into her beauty. Next day, having arranged the ugly copybooks alphabetically, I plunged into their chaos of scripts and came prematurely to Valesky and Vane, whose books I had somehow misplaced. The first was dressed up for the occasion in a semblance of legibility, but Sybil's work displayed her usual combination of several demon hands. She had begun in very pale, very hard pencil, which had conspicuously embossed the blank verso, but had produced little of permanent value on the upper side of the page. Happily the tip soon broke, and Sybil continued in another, darker lead, gradually lapsing into the blurred thickness of what looked almost like charcoal, to which, by sucking the blunt point, she had contributed some traces of lipstick. Her work, although even poorer than I had expected, bore all the signs of a kind of desperate conscientiousness, with underscores, transposes, unnecessary footnotes, as if she were intent upon rounding up things in the most respectable manner possible. Then she had borrowed Mary Volesky's fountain pen and added, in French, "This exam is finished, as is my life. Goodbye, young women. Please, Mr. Professor, contact my sister and tell her that death was not better than D minus, but definitely better than life minus D." I lost no time in ringing up Cynthia, who told me it was all over, had been all over since 8 in the morning, and asked me to bring her the note, and when I did, beamed through her tears with proud admiration for the whimsical use, just like her, Sybil had made of an examination in French literature. In no time she fixed 2 highballs, while never parting with Sybil's notebook, by now splashed with soda water and tears, and went on studying the death message, whereupon I was impelled to point out to her the grammatical mistakes in it, and to explain the way girl is translated in American colleges, lest students innocently bandy about the French equivalent of wench or worse. These rather tasteless trivialities pleased Cynthia hugely as she rose, with gasps, above the heaving surface of her grief. And then, holding that limp notebook as if it were a kind of passport to a casual Elysium, where pencil points do not snap and a dreamy young beauty with an impeccable complexion winds a lock of her hair on a dreamy forefinger as she meditates over some celestial test, Cynthia led me upstairs to a chilly little bedroom, just to show me, as if I were the police or a sympathetic Irish neighbor, two empty pill bottles, and the tumbled bed from which a tender, inessential body that Dee must have known down to its last velvet detail had been already removed. 3. It was 4 or 5 months after her sister's death that I began seeing Cynthia fairly often. By the time I had come to New York for some vocational research in the public library, she had also moved to that city where, for some odd reason, in vague connection, I presume, with artistic motives, she had taken what people, immune to gooseflesh, term a cold-water flat down in the scale of the city's transverse streets. What attracted me were neither her ways, which I thought repulsively vivacious, nor her looks, which other men thought striking. She had wide-spaced eyes very much like her sister's, of a frank, frightened blue with dark points in a radial arrangement. The interval between her thick black eyebrows was always shiny, and shiny too were the fleshy volutes of her nostrils. The coarse texture of her epiderm looked almost masculine, and in the dark lamplight of her studio you could see the pores of her 32-year-old face fairly gaping at you like something in an aquarium. She used cosmetics with as much zest as her little sister had, but with an additional slovenliness which would result in her big front teeth getting some of the rouge. She was handsomely dark, wore a not too tasteless mixture of fairly smart, heterogeneous things, and had a so-called good figure, but all of her was curiously frowsy, after a way I obscurely associated with left-wing enthusiasms in politics and advanced banalities in art, although actually she cared for neither. Her coily hairdo, on a part-and-bun basis, might have looked feral and bizarre had it not been thoroughly domesticated by its own soft unkemptness at the vulnerable nape. Her fingernails were gaudily painted, but badly bitten and not clean. Her lovers were a silent young photographer with a sudden laugh and two older men, brothers, who owned a small printing establishment across the street. I wondered at their tastes whenever I glimpsed, with a secret shudder, the higgledy-piggledy striation of black hairs that showed all along her pale shins through the nylon of her stockings, with the scientific distinctness of a preparation flattened under glass. Or when I felt, at her every movement, the dullish, stalish, not particularly conspicuous but all-pervading and depressing emanation that her seldom-bathed flesh spread from under weary perfumes and creams. Her father had gambled away the greater part of a comfortable fortune, and her mother's first husband had been of Slav origin, but otherwise Cynthia Vane belonged to a good, respectable family. For aught we know, it may have gone back to kings and soothsayers in the midst of ultimate islands. Transferred to a newer world, to a landscape of doomed, splendid, deciduous trees, her ancestry presented, in one of its first phases, a white churchful of farmers against a black thunderhead, and then an imposing array of townsmen engaged in mercantile pursuits, as well as a number of learned men, such as Dr. Jonathan Vane, the Gaunt Boar, 1780-1839, who perished in the conflagration of the steamer Lexington to become later an habitué of Cynthia's tilting table. I've always wished to stand genealogy on its head, and here I have an opportunity to do so, for it is the last scion, Cynthia, and Cynthia alone, who will remain of any importance in the Vane dynasty. I'm alluding, of course, to her artistic gift, to her delightful, gay, but not very popular paintings, which the friends of her friends bought at long intervals, and I dearly should like to know where they went after her death, those honest and poetical pictures that illumined her living room, the wonderfully detailed images of metallic things, and my favorite, seen through a windshield partly covered with rime, with a brilliant trickle from an imaginary car roof, across its transparent part, and through it all the sapphire flame of the sky and a green and white fir tree. 4. Cynthia had a feeling that her dead sister was not altogether pleased with her, had discovered by now that she and I had conspired to break her romance, and so, in order to disarm her shade, Cynthia reverted to a rather primitive type of sacrificial offering, tinged, however, with something of Sybil's humor, and began to send to Dee's business address, at deliberately unfixed dates, such trifles as snapshots of Sybil's tomb in a poor light, cuttings of her own hair which was indistinguishable from Sybil's, a New England sectional map with an inked-in cross, midway between two chaste towns, to mark the spot where Dee and Sybil had stopped on October the 23rd, in broad daylight at a lenient motel in a pink and brown forest, and twice a stuffed skunk. Being as a conversationalist more voluble than explicit, she never could describe in full the theory of intervenient auras that she had somehow evolved. Fundamentally, there was nothing particularly new about her private creed, since it presupposed a fairly conventional hereafter, a silent solarium of immortal souls, spliced with mortal antecedents, whose main recreation consisted of periodical hoverings over the dear quick. The interesting point was a curious practical twist that Cynthia gave to her tame metaphysics. She was sure that her existence was influenced by all sorts of dead friends, each of whom took turns in directing her fate, much as if she were a stray kitten which a schoolgirl in passing gathers up and presses to her cheek and carefully puts down again near some suburban hedge, to be stroked presently by another transient hand, or carried off to a world of doors by some hospitable lady. For a few hours, or for several days in a row, and sometimes recurrently, in an irregular series, for months or years, anything that happened to Cynthia after a given person had died would be, she said, in the manner and mood of that person. The event might be extraordinary, changing the course of one's life, or it might be a string of minute incidents just sufficiently clear to stand out in relief against one's usual day, and then shading off into still vaguer trivia as the aura gradually faded. The influence might be good or bad. The main thing was that its source could be identified. It was like walking through a person's soul, she said. I tried to argue that she might not always be able to determine the exact source, since not everybody has a recognizable soul, that there are anonymous letters and Christmas presents which anybody might send, that, in fact, what Cynthia called a usual day might be itself a weak solution of mixed auras or simply the routine shift of a humdrum guardian angel. And what about God? Did or did not people who would resent any omnipotent dictator on earth look forward to one in heaven? And wars. What a dreadful idea. Dead soldiers still fighting with living ones, or phantom armies trying to get at each other through the lives of crippled old men. But Cynthia was above generalities, as she was beyond logic. Ah, that's Paul, she would say when the soup spitefully boiled over. Or, I guess good Betty Brown is dead, when she won a beautiful and very welcome vacuum cleaner in a charity lottery. And, with Jamesian meanderings that exasperated my French mind, she would go back to a time when Betty and Paul had not yet departed, and tell me of the showers of well-meant but odd and quite unacceptable bounties, beginning with an old purse that contained a check for $3 which she picked up in the street, and of course returned, to the aforesaid Betty Brown. This is where she first comes in, a decrepit colored woman hardly able to walk, and ending with an insulting proposal from an old beau of hers, this is where Paul comes in, to paint straight pictures of his house and family for a reasonable remuneration, all of which followed upon the demise of a certain Mrs. Page, a kindly but petty old party who had pestered her with bits of matter-of-fact advice since Cynthia had been a child. Sybil's personality, she said, had a rainbow edge as if a little out of focus. She said that had I known Sybil better, I would have at once understood how Sybil-like was the aura of minor events which, in spells, had suffused her, Cynthia's, existence after Sybil's suicide. Ever since they had lost their mother, they had intended to give up their Boston home and move to New York, where Cynthia's paintings, they thought, would have a chance to be more widely admired. But the old home had clung to them with all its plush tentacles. Dead Sybil, however, had proceeded to separate the house from its view, a thing that affects fatally the sense of home. Right across the narrow street, a building project had come into loud, ugly, scaffolded life. A pair of familiar poplars died that spring, turning to blonde skeletons. Workmen came and broke up the warm-colored, lovely old sidewalk that had a special violet sheen on wet April days, and had echoed so memorably to the morning footsteps of museum-bound Mr. Lever, who, upon retiring from business at 60, had devoted a full quarter of a century exclusively to the study of snails. Speaking of old men, one should add that sometimes these posthumous auspices and interventions were in the nature of parody. Cynthia had been on friendly terms with an eccentric librarian called Porlock, who, in the last years of his dusty life, had been in engaged in examining old books for miraculous misprints, such as the substitution of I for the second H in the word hither. Contrary to Cynthia, he cared nothing for the thrill of obscure predictions. All he sought was the freak itself, the chance that mimics choice, the flaw that looks like a flower. And Cynthia, much more a perverse amateur of misshapen or illicitly connected words, puns, logogriffs, and so on, had helped the poor crank to pursue a quest that, in the light of the example she cited, struck me as statistically insane. Anyway, she said, on the third day after his death, she was reading a magazine and had just come across a quotation from an imperishable poem that she, with other gullible readers, believed to have been really composed in a dream, when it dawned upon her that Alf was a prophetic sequence of the initial letters of Anna Livia Plurabelle, another sacred river running through, or rather around, yet another fake dream, while the additional H modestly stood as a private signpost for the word that had so hypnotized Mr. Porlock. And I wish I could recollect that novel or short story, by some contemporary writer, I believe, in which, unknown to its author, the first letters of the words in its last paragraph formed, as deciphered by Cynthia, a message from his dead mother. 5. I am sorry to say that, not content with these ingenious fancies, Cynthia showed a ridiculous fondness for spiritualism. I refused to accompany her to sittings in which paid mediums took part. I knew too much about that from other sources. I did consent, however, to attend little farces rigged up by Cynthia and her two poker-faced gentlemen friends of the printing shop. They were podgy, polite, and rather eerie old fellows, but I satisfied myself that they possessed considerable wit and culture. We sat down at a light little table, and crackling tremors started almost as soon as we laid our fingertips upon it. I was treated to an assortment of ghosts who rapped out their reports most readily, though refusing to elucidate anything that I did not quite catch. Oscar Wilde came in, and in rapid, garbled French, with the usual anglicisms, obscurely accused Cynthia's dead parents of what appeared in my jottings as plagiate seem. A brisk spirit contributed the unsolicited information that he, John Moore, and his brother Bill had been coal miners in Colorado and had perished in an avalanche at Crested Butte in January 1883. Frederick Myers, an old hand at the game, hammered out a piece of verse, oddly resembling Cynthia's own fugitive productions, which in part reads in my notes, "What is this, a conjurer's rabbit, or a fly but genuine gleam, which can check the perilous habit and dispel the dolorous dream?" Finally, with a great crash and all kinds of shudderings and jig-like movements on the part of the table, Leo Tolstoy visited our little group, and when asked to identify himself by specific traits of terrene habitation, launched upon a complex description of what seemed to be some Russian type of architectural woodwork. Figures on boards, man, horse, cock, man, horse, cock, all of which was difficult to take down, hard to understand, and impossible to verify. I attended two or three other sittings, which were even sillier, but I must confess that I preferred the childish entertainment they afforded and the cider we drank. Podgy and Pudgy were teetotalers, to Cynthia's awful house parties. She gave them at the Wheelers' nice flat next door, the sort of arrangement dear to her centrifugal nature, but then, of course, her own living room always looked like a dirty old pallet. Following a barbaric, unhygienic, and adulterous custom, the guests' coats, still warm on the inside, were carried by quiet, baldish Bob Wheeler into the sanctity of a tidy bedroom and heaped on the conjugal bed. It was also he who poured out the drinks, which were passed around by the young photographer, while Cynthia and Mrs. Wheeler took care of the canapés. A late arrival had the impression of lots of loud people unnecessarily grouped with a smoke-blue space between two mirrors gorged with reflections. Because, I suppose, Cynthia wished to be the youngest in the room, the women she used to invite, married or single, were, at the best, in their precarious 40s. Some of them would bring from their homes, in dark taxis, intact vestiges of good looks, which, however, they lost as the party progressed. It has always amazed me, the capacity sociable weekend revelers have of finding almost at once, by a purely empiric but very precise method, a common denominator of drunkenness, to which everybody loyally sticks before descending, all together, to the next level. The rich friendliness of the matrons was marked by tomboyish overtones, while the fixed inward look of amiably tight men was like a sacrilegious parody of pregnancy. Although some of the guests were connected in one way or another with the arts, there was no inspired talk, no wreathed elbow-propped heads, and of course no flute girls. From some vantage point where she'd been sitting in a stranded mermaid pose on the pale carpet with one or two younger fellows, Cynthia, her face varnished with a film of beaming sweat, would creep up on her knees, a proffered plate of nuts in one hand, and crisply tap with the other the athletic leg of Cochrane or Corcoran, an art dealer, ensconced on a pearl-gray sofa between two flushed, happily disintegrating ladies. At a further stage there would come spurts of more riotous gaiety. Corcoran or Koransky would grab Cynthia or some other wandering woman by the shoulder and lead her into a corner to confront her with a grinning imbroglio of private jokes and rumors, whereupon, with a laugh and a toss of her head, she would break away. And still later there would be flurries of intersexual chumminess, jocular reconciliations, a bare fleshy arm flung around another woman's husband, he standing very upright in the midst of a swaying room, or a sudden rush of flirtatious anger, of clumsy pursuit, and the quiet half-smile of Bob Wheeler picking up glasses that grew like mushrooms in the shade of chairs. After one last party of that sort, I wrote Cynthia a perfectly harmless and, on the whole, well-meant note, in which I poked a little Latin fun at some of her guests. I also apologized for not having touched her whiskey, saying that as a Frenchman I preferred the grape to the grain. A few days later I met her on the steps of the public library, in the broken sun, under a weak cloudburst, opening her amber umbrella, struggling with a couple of armpitted books, of which I relieved her for a moment, Footfalls on the Boundary of Another World by Robert Dale Owen, and Something on Spiritualism and Christianity, when suddenly, with no provocation on my part, she blazed out at me with vulgar vehemence, using poisonous words, saying, through pear-shaped drops of sparse rain, that I was a prig and a snob, that I only saw the gestures and disguises of people, that Corcoran had rescued from drowning in two different oceans two men, by an irrelevant coincidence both called Corcoran, that romping and screeching Joan Winter had a little girl doomed to grow completely blind in a few months, and that the woman in green with the freckled chest, whom I had snubbed in some way or other, had written a national bestseller in 1932. Strange Cynthia! I had been told she could be thunderously rude to people whom she liked and respected. One had, however, to draw the line somewhere, and since I had by then sufficiently studied her interesting auras and other odds and ids, I decided to stop seeing her altogether. 6. The night D informed me of Cynthia's death, I returned after 11 to the two-storied house I shared, in horizontal section, with an emeritus professor's widow. Upon reaching the porch, I looked with the apprehension of solitude at the two kinds of darkness in the two rows of windows, the darkness of absence and the darkness of sleep. I could do something about the first, but could not duplicate the second. My bed gave me no sense of safety. Its springs only made my nerves bounce. I plunged into Shakespeare's sonnets and found myself idiotically checking the first letters of the lines to see what sacramental words they might form. I got fate, LXX, Adam, CXX, and twice, Taft, LXXXVIII, CXXXI. Every now and then I would glance around to see how the objects in my room were behaving. It was strange to think that if bombs began to fall, I would feel little more than a gambler's excitement and a great deal of earthy relief, whereas my heart would burst if a certain suspiciously tense-looking little bottle on yonder shelf moved a fraction of an inch to one side. The silence, too, was suspiciously compact, as if deliberately forming a black backdrop for the nerve flash caused by any small sound of unknown origin. All traffic was dead. In vain did I pray for the groan of a truck up Perkins Street. The woman above, who used to drive me crazy by the booming thuds occasioned by what seemed monstrous feet of stone, actually, in diurnal life she was a small dumpy creature resembling a mummified guinea pig, would have earned my blessings had she now trudged to her bathroom. I put out my light and cleared my throat several times so as to be responsible for at least that sound. I thumbed a mental ride with a very remote automobile, but it dropped me before I had a chance to doze off. Presently a crackle, due, I hope, to a discarded and crushed sheet of paper opening like a mean, stubborn night flower, started and stopped in the waste paper basket, and my bed table responded with a little click. It would have been just like Cynthia to put on right then a cheap poltergeist show. I decided to fight Cynthia. I reviewed and thought the modern era of raps and apparitions, beginning with the knockings of 1848 at the hamlet of Hydesville, New York, and ending with grotesque phenomena at Cambridge, Massachusetts. I evoked the ankle bones and other anatomical castanets of the Fox sisters, as described by the sages of the University of Buffalo, the mysteriously uniformed type of delicate adolescent in bleak Epworth or Tedworth, radiating the same disturbances as in old Peru, solemn Victorian orgies with roses falling and accordions floating to the strains of sacred music, professional impostors regurgitating moist cheesecloth, Mr. Duncan, a ladies' medium dignified husband, who, when asked if he would submit to a search, excused himself on the ground of soiled underwear. Old Alfred Russel Wallace, the naive naturalist, refusing to believe that the white form with bare feet and unperforated earlobes before him, at a private pandemonium in Boston, could be prim Miss Cook, whom he had just seen asleep, in her curtained corner, all dressed in black, wearing laced-up boots and earrings. Two other investigators, small, puny, but reasonably intelligent and active men, closely clinging with arms and legs about Eusapia, a large, plump, elderly female reeking of garlic, who still managed to fool them, and the skeptical and embarrassed magician, instructed by charming young Marjorie's control, not to get lost in the bathrobe's lining, but to follow up the left stocking until he reached the bare thigh, upon the warm skin of which he felt a teleplastic mass that appeared to the touch uncommonly like cold, uncooked liver. 7. I was appealing to flesh and the corruption of flesh to refute and defeat the possible persistence of discarnate life. Alas, these conjurations only enhanced my fear of Cynthia's phantom. Atavistic peace came with dawn, and when I slipped into sleep, the sun through the tawny window shades penetrated a dream that somehow was full of Cynthia. This was disappointing. Secure in the fortress of daylight, I said to myself that I had expected more. She, a painter of glass-bright minutiae, and now so vague. I lay in bed thinking my dream over and listening to the sparrows outside. Who knows if recorded and then run backward, those birds' sounds might not become human speech, voiced words just as the latter become a twitter when reversed. I set myself to reread my dream backward, diagonally, up, down, trying hard to unravel something Cynthia-like in it, something strange and suggestive that must be there. I could isolate, consciously, little. Everything seemed blurred, yellow-clouded, yielding nothing tangible. Her inept acrostics, maudlin evasions, theopathies, every recollection formed ripples of mysterious meaning. Everything seemed yellowly blurred, elusive, lost. And that story was The Vane Sisters by Vladimir Nabokov, from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. The last story is from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. Dinner Time by Russell Edson. An old man sitting at a table was waiting for his wife to serve dinner. He heard her beating a pot that had burned her. He hated the sound of a pot when it was beaten, for it advertised its pain in such a way that made him wish to inflict more of the same. And he began to punch at his own face, and his knuckles were red. How he hated red knuckles, that blaring color, more self-important than the wound. He heard his wife drop the entire dinner on the kitchen floor with a curse, for as she was carrying it in, it had burned her thumb. He heard the forks and spoons, the cups and platters, all cry at once as they landed on the kitchen floor. How he hated a dinner that, once prepared, begins to burn one to death, and as if that weren't enough, screeches and roars as it lands on the floor where it belongs anyway. He punched himself again and fell on the floor. When he came awake again, he was quite angry, and so he punched himself again and felt dizzy. Dizziness made him angry, and so he began to hit his head against the wall, saying, "Now get real dizzy if you want to get dizzy. He slumped to the floor. "Oh, the legs won't work, eh?" He began to punch his legs. He had taught his head a lesson, and now he would teach his legs a lesson. Meanwhile, he heard his wife smashing the remaining dinnerware and the dinnerware roaring and shrieking. He saw himself in the mirror on the wall. "Oh, mock me, will you?" And so he smashed the mirror with a chair, which broke. "Oh, don't want to be a chair no more. Too good to be sat on, eh?" He began to beat the pieces of the chair. He heard his wife beating the stove with an axe. He called, "When we're going to eat," as he stuffed a candle in his mouth. "When I'm good and ready," she screamed. "Want me to punch your bun?" he screamed. "Come near me and I'll kick an eye out of your head. I'll cut your ears off. I'll give you a slap right in the face. I'll kick you right in the bread basket. I'll break you in half." The old man finally ate one of his hands. The old woman said, "Damn fool, why'd you cook it first? You go on like a beast. You know I have to subdue the kitchen every night, otherwise it'll cook me and serve me to the mice on my best china. And you know what small eaters they are. Next would come the flies, and how I hate flies in my kitchen." The old man swallowed a spoon. "Okay," said the old woman, "now we're short one spoon." The old man, growing angry, swallowed himself. "Okay," the woman said, "now you've done it." And that story was Dinner Time by Russell Edson from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.